My name is Dick Taylor, for those of you who haven't been at our other sessions, and this is Phyllis Taylor. And the other two, we really divided up very, I mean, the other three sessions we did, we really divided up very evenly. This time, since I'm a little bit more involved with homelessness, I'm going to take the lead on it. And tomorrow, since Phyllis is a lot more involved in medical ethics, she's going to take the lead and I'm going to be the backup person. My background is that I've worked, that is, as far as homelessness goes, is that I've worked for the last 3 years in a faith-based shelter for homeless men in Philadelphia that's called My Brother's House. And 3 years does not an expert make in this field. So I just wanted to share some of the things that I've learned, but I know others may have had their own experiences, and certainly people have read in this field. So I'm kind of going to be looking to you also to pull out a picture of homelessness and also what we think could be done about homelessness in this richest country in the world. Just to say a word about the Bethesda Project. That's the broader name of the organization that I'm a part of. And we chose the word Bethesda, or the founders did, because in Hebrew, Beth means house, and Chesed means God's loving kindness. So the idea was to have places where God's loving kindness could really be shown to the poorest and the most vulnerable of our people who end up on the city streets. And the mission of this group is to try to make family with the abandoned poor. So we have shelters for both men and women, and then we also have what are called single room occupancy dwellings, which are like apartments where a person is no longer sleeping in a dormitory like you do in a shelter, but has their own room with their own key and their own space to hold their stuff. My background is professionally is in social work, and I work primarily with Latino or Hispanic men, although 90% of the people who come to us are not Latino. One of the things that we did at early on was to start a little study group, because most of our day-to-day work is in just direct service with the people that are coming to us. How can we get this man medical care? How can we get this guy into a substance abuse program? How can we find this person housing? But we really felt that although it's extremely important to give that direct, kind, loving care service to the individuals that come to us, we also have a responsibility to look at what are the causes, what's producing this homelessness. So we started this this little macro study group, as we call it, macro meaning the broader picture, and we called it the same as what we're calling this session, the homelessness, the causes and cures. We felt like the root causes issue is very important, and I was reminded as we were beginning the seminar about something that Dom Helder Câmara said. He's a Brazilian bishop, and he said, when I fed the hungry, they called me a saint. When I asked, why are they hungry? They called me a communist. And so the same thing here. If you help the homeless, people are likely to pat you on the back. If you say, why are they homeless? You may get other kinds of reactions. So within the limits of time, we want to look into some of these causes today. Rather than first describe homelessness, is there anyone here who works in a homeless shelter or volunteers in a homeless shelter or anything like that? Okay, one person back there. Okay. I wanted to do just a little kind of imaginative exercise to give you maybe a feel of what it's like to be homeless. And this is a real easy exercise, no embarrassing things in it, but just to sort of get a feel of what it's like to be homeless. And I'd like you just to close your eyes and sort of be quiet. And call to mind, imagine your own house or apartment where you live. What's it look like as you walk up to it? What's it look like as you walk through it? Can you see your living room in your mind's eye, maybe the couch? Maybe a television. What's your bathroom look like? Do you have a shower or a tub? Where do you keep the toothpaste? Do you have one phone, a couple of phones, three phones? Do you have a radio or two? What's the kitchen look like? Are there cabinets with the dishes and pots and pans? You have a stove, you have a refrigerator. Where do you keep the food? Where's the cereal go? Take a look in your mind's eye at your bedroom. Where do you keep your clothes? And you see the closet, what it looks like when you swing open the door. Your bureau, how many drawers do you have in the bureau? If you have a car, you might just kind of picture that in your mind's eye. Or if you have a bike or some other means of transportation, what that looks like. And I'd like you to imagine yourself just sitting at the dining room table and pulling out your wallet or your purse and spreading out your ID on the table there. What do you have in the wallet? You have credit cards, driver's license, a bank card. And then just imagine the kind of people who come to visit you at your house. Family members, friends, others. But just kind of keep your eyes closed and keep all these things in mind. And let's imagine now what it would be like to be homeless. So now you're not at this house anymore, or this apartment, but you're on the street. So we have to take away the bathroom. Where do you get a shower now or a bath? How do you brush your teeth? Maybe you can slip into the bathroom at the McDonald's. Maybe they won't notice you and throw you out. But you're going to start smelling pretty soon. You've got to take away the kitchen. No more food that you can just reach up and grab hold of. No way to cook. No way to keep anything cold. How are you going to eat? You probably will need to, just to survive, you're going to have to find out real quickly where are the soup kitchens in this city or town? How far apart are they? What's their schedule? Are there days when they don't serve food? Which ones have the best food? How far apart are they? We've got to take away the bedroom. You don't have any clothes except the one set on your back. Just imagine yourself. If you were out on the street, what clothes would you wear? What would you choose to wear? Maybe you might carry a bag with another set in there, but it's hard to all day long be carrying stuff around. Do you normally change your underwear, your shirt every day or every couple of days? You're not going to be able to do that anymore. They're going to get dirty pretty fast. You have no bed. There's no money to go to a motel or to rent a room. Your choices really are down now to either finding a shelter where you can stay, or some kind of place on the street. There's some construction over by the bridge. You could crawl up in under the bridge and lay down on top of that construction. If it's winter, if your city has a steam system, there'll be some heat vents, and that's really a good spot to be, except if it carries a lot of moisture, you're going to get wet. You'll get the warmth will be good, but the wet will be bad. You'll need some cardboard to lay down on. A goes without saying that you don't have a car or a bike or any way to get around, so you have to hoof it everywhere. You hear about a job possibility over on the east side of town, but then you know the only place they're have an open soup kitchen is on the west side of town. Can you make it walking from the job interview way back to the soup kitchen, or are you going to have to skip lunch today? Well, luckily you've been able to carry your ID, at least you've got your wallet. But while you're sleeping that night on the street, somebody comes along with a little razor and just goes zip on your back pocket, and you don't even realize that you were so tired from walking all day that they got your wallet so easily. So when you try to go to that job interview, they say, let me see some ID. You got nothing to offer. You don't have a phone. You applied for a job at a temporary jobs agency, and they said, yeah, we've got jobs. Where can we reach you if something comes up? You've got no place to welcome friends, to say, come on in, make yourself at home. You're dirty, you're smelly, you're tired, you're hungry. You're real tempted to beg. When you sit on the sidewalk to rest, people make this big circle to kind of get around you, and a lot of people say to you, why don't you get a job? You're homeless, you're pushed to the very margins of society, and you've joined about 3 million other Americans. Well, you can open your eyes. Yeah. I often kind of go through that when I meet people who are homeless, because for some people it is that kind of stripping. Phyllis and I had a friend. We were living in West Philadelphia, and we had a dog, a beagle. They really liked the suburbs a lot better than the city. And so we gave this dog to a friend who lived out in a very, very nice suburb where she had a big yard and lots of place for the beagle to run. And we sort of lost track of her. And last year, while I was working in the shelter, I heard that our women's shelter had a woman who was saying that she knew me and that she had taken care of our dog. And so I zipped over to see, and indeed it was this woman. Now, she had been living in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, which, if you know, is a beautiful, beautiful suburb of Swarthmore College, and you know, very green and lots of trees. She had become, she was married to a psychiatrist. She had become mentally ill, and I suppose he did everything that he could, but she was hospitalized a number of times. Eventually they were divorced. She kind of slipped through various cracks of the mental health system, and to make a long story short, she ended up sleeping under a bush on Rittenhouse Square, which is one of the parks in Philadelphia. So here was this person that at one time she was the recipient of our dog because she lived in such a beautiful, spacious house with a yard in the suburbs. And just a few years later, she was sleeping under a bush in Center City. How did so much homelessness come about? You know, there have always been hobos. There's always been people who sort of chose the life on the road. But in the 1980s, people suddenly started recognizing that there were a lot more people on the street than people had seen before. This was not just the guy jumping the fast freight, you know, and eating out of a tin can over a fire. The soup kitchens were overflowing. Churches were having to set up new soup kitchens all the time. Lots more people on the downtown streets. Question, did people somehow suddenly find vagrancy and being a hobo appealing? You know, did 2.9 million people suddenly decide this is a great lifestyle? That would be ridiculous. They didn't suddenly decide it's more comfortable to sleep on a sleeping vent than in a bed. Something was happening in society that was causing this to come about. Some broad social and economic changes they were bringing this about. So I'd like us to do a little exercise here. I brought some scrap paper.
Do you want to just bring some?
I want to pass it out. And we'd like you just to write down, here's some pen, or some pencils too. Write down what you think are the three main causes of homelessness in the United States. Okay?
The increase in homelessness are the three main causes in it.
Well, the causes of homelessness, what we see now. Why are there so many people homeless? We don't need a, I'm not looking for a big essay here, just a couple of words like alcoholism or, you know, whatever you feel would be. Now, when you have that down, put beside each one a percentage figure for how much you think it is a cause. Like if you have three things listed there, is one sort of 50% of the cause of homelessness, and the other is 25%, and the other is 25%, or is there one that's 90%, and the others are only 5% each, or what? Do you see what I mean? Try to show which is you think is the biggest cause of homelessness, and which are a little bit less. So each one should have a percentage figure beside it. Okay, now what we want to do is just kind of quickly get these up and list them, and when you write, like if somebody says, alcoholism, make a note about how many people say that and what the different percentage figures are. Okay, why don't we just start over here?
I wrote alcohol as the number one.
Okay. And what was your percentage figure?
I used 50.
50? Okay. And keep going. The others?
Drugs.
Drugs, okay. Mm-hmm. Figure?
25.
Okay. And?
Mental problems.
Okay. Okay, next? Oh, sorry, what was your percent?
25,
yeah, okay.
Sorry about that.
Math is not my field.
Lack of job skills for the available market.
Okay.
And I said 25%. And then I said the tightening of employment. I think there's a little difference there.
Okay.
As factories closed in certain areas and so on.
Okay.
And I gave 25 there. And then I said, I consider alcohol and drug abuse together, so the drug dependency.
Just addiction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I had 50% for the two together, so.
25 and 25. Okay. Just kind of keep going here.
I had mental illness.
Okay.
40%.
40.
Federal program cutbacks. 40. And lack of affordable housing.
Okay.
Which is, I mean, there's a lot lumped under federal cutbacks, but I separated them.
Okay.
And how many was, what was the percentage?
Cutbacks 40, not, and then unaffordable housing 20.
Okay,
Meg. Mine are kind of harder to word, so I'll try to explain it.
Okay.
One was just the cycle that if you're, which someone kind of mentioned, if you're poor, or even if you're not poor and you're not, you don't get educated right, if you, then you can't get the right jobs, you know, all those things that you can't get this, you can't get that, and it just leads to more and more. And then if you're homeless and you don't have a place to live, then you can't get a job because you don't have a place to write down for them to all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then
cycle poverty.
The imbalance of wealth in our nation, kind of how the middle class is slowly depleting and it's getting to be these extremes. And I kind of put three things with there. That's kind of the same thing. So basically those two.
And Heather, the percentages?
I don't put them.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. I have mental illness, 30%.
drugs and alcohol I lumped together for 50%.
Okay.
And then breakdown of family.
Family.
20.
Okay.
I kind of had drugs that would be 50%. And 25% each for reduced government aid at all levels. Mm-hmm. And breakdown in the traditional family.
So that could be runaways and divorce and everything?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I cut federal programs 40%. Downturn in the economy, which resulted in, and job, and the difference
that's
in jobs, meaning that most of the jobs are at low income, was 30%.
Wait a minute, sorry.
But just
federal program cutback is 40%.
Right, and then the economy. And so.
Okay, and then the economy.
Uh-huh. Put economy.
Tight, yeah. Would be 30%. Most of the jobs are coming at the low end of the scale. Support family on. And I put attitudes, mental, alcohol, drugs, mental health, all under attitudes, and I put that at 30%. So it'd be 10% each year.
Okay. Yeah.
I put mental illness 70%.
Are you in the field?
No, but I have a brother-in-law who's mentally ill. I put drugs 15, but I think I probably meant drugs and alcohol together.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just put hopelessness 15. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Pass.
Okay.
I put lack of mental illness facilities, which would go along with mental illness,
uh-huh.
And loss of jobs, and drug and alcohol dependencies. I didn't put percentages.
Okay.
Loss of jobs. Which would be lack of job skills also, not being able
it's
to.
It's almost
find
both.
That. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I have my job skills 25%. Breakdown in the family, which included runaways and things like that, 25%, and addictions, 50%.
Okay.
Okay, I put job loss, so I don't know where that would be, maybe tightening of employment or something, as 30.
Tightening of employment, right under lack of job skills.
And then I just said divorce, but I guess that family.
And
more appropriate,
and
I put 20, and then I said
addictions
for 50.
Okay.
Well, substance abuse, 40% change in government programs such as welfare, Medicaid, that sort of thing, that's 40%. The breakdown of the family structure is about 20%.
They do cover, you know, a whole bunch of the causes of homelessness. Certainly, at least in terms of our little study, we would have certainly touched on all of these. It was interesting. I was trying to listen to how people framed it as they framed it, and it was interesting. Like on mental illness, most people said mental illness. A couple of people said lack of facilities for the mentally ill or reduced facilities for the mentally ill. And it's kind of a different way to look at it. If you think, well, homelessness is caused because people become mentally ill, it's sort of like, well, something happened to them as an individual and they became homeless. Whereas if you say, we haven't done a good enough job to provide services for the mentally ill, then the responsibility is more a societal
mm-hmm.
responsibility. The same thing on now, federal program cutbacks, a number of people, there are five, mentioned that. That's more looking at the social
mm-hmm.
and political dimension. If we were in a more conservative kind of audience here, people might have said laziness, sloth, you know, people not taking responsibility for themselves, you know, not looking at the what's happened in the broader society, but more the individual kind of thing. Lack of job skills, that's kind of interesting because there's an implication that something happened along the way that the person didn't get the job skills. But again, the focus is a little bit more on the individual, why didn't I get that course in the vocational school so I had something, you know, secure to work with? But the other way to look at it would be lack of adequate programs to really train people for the kind of economy that we have. When an industry goes bust or moves to Korea or Mexico or something, why do so many people just suddenly become unemployed in a country like Sweden or Norway, where a lot of Lutherans come from? They have this incredible training system where the company has to let the government know before they close, and then has to help fund new training for the employees, and the government has all these incredible subsidies for retraining people and moving people all over the country to new jobs and all that kind of thing. So it's sort of a whole system to prevent people from falling into poverty when an industry isn't able to make it. So just kind of pointing out that. And there's a friend of mine, a woman who is director of a homeless shelter up in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And people say to her, well, how are things going? You know, are you making any progress? And the answer that they want to hear is, yeah, I got so-and-so into a substance abuse program, and so-and-so, who was an alcoholic, is really doing better now. He's had, you know, a month of sobriety. And it's sort of like individuals. And that's great. I mean, that's important. That's a lot of what I do, is working with individuals. But her answer always is, because she wants to get people thinking a little bit more societally, is, nah, things are still bad. I mean, there's no decent housing programs in this country. We don't really have decent job training. Medicine is still a private thing, you know. A person gets sick and all their savings can go into medical bills and they fall into poverty. Why don't we have a decent medical care system like most modern industrialized countries have? You know, it's sort of a whole different way of looking at it. Well, I wanted to look at just a couple of things, and they're ones that have been mentioned already, and then, you know, we can have a little bit more discussion, and I wanted to do another exercise before we end up. One is the housing that people talked about, lack of affordable housing. And I think it's good just to put some kind of concrete numbers under that as to what's happened. Over the last 10 years, we've had a pretty strong free enterprise philosophy in government. And a lot of kind of the philosophy of getting the government off people's backs, getting the government out of things, letting private enterprise handle things more. And the results in housing have been really pretty dramatic. In 1978, before this kind of transition happened, the government was spending on housing about 7% of the federal budget. 1988, when this new philosophy had kind of really taken hold, that amount had been cut to 0.7% of the federal budget. At the beginning of the Reagan administration, back in 1981, the government was spending $32.2 billion for housing programs, and today it's $7.5 billion. So that's a 75% cut. And many of those were programs for low-income people. A program that has benefited us a lot in Philadelphia, and I'm sure it has all over the country, is one called Section 8 housing. Are people familiar with that a little bit? The basic idea is that the federal government makes up the difference between what a person can pay for rent and the actual economic rent. So in our place, for example, a person who's on public assistance pays $59 a month for our single room occupancy house. The economic cost of that, the apartment of the room, is $300 a month, and the federal government makes up the difference between the two. So somebody who's really poor and couldn't afford housing in the regular housing market through this is able to get really a pretty nice room in a place that we rehabbed, and it has a nice kitchen and, you know, a TV room and that type of thing. And it helps a lot of people who couldn't get any room in the normal housing market to get it. What happened is that this program has been almost completely eliminated now, or is much, much less funded than it had been. And so that a lot of private developers, and both profit-making a nonprofit had gotten into the Section 8 housing and had produced, a lot of church organizations produced a lot of Section 8 housing to, because they knew it was an effective way to help poor people and to impact homelessness, to get people off the streets because they didn't have to pay as much. What's going to happen now is that when the Section 8 money runs out, they're going to have to suddenly start charging the economic rent. So the person that was paying $59 a month is going to have to pay $300 a month. And that just isn't going to be possible. The New York Times estimated a while back that we may lose in the next 5 years 800,000 units of such housing. So it may be, if the figure of homeless people in the United States is now somewhere around 3 million, it may be that at the end of 5 years we'll have 3,800,000 of people who will be out in the streets just because of that one thing.
So that is that low-income housing you're talking about, is that the same thing?
Well, there are a number of different programs. Section 8 is one of them. Yeah. Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say that this, it's not just low-income housing, because they can rent anything that any landlord, at least in Washington State, any landlord will agree to rent on a Section 8 type thing. So that you can, you know, you can find your, but they do have certain qualifications depending on how many people. It has to be so many bedrooms, you know, that type of thing. It has to meet certain standards. But.
I think a lot of families have relied on Section 8, so when you talk about 800,000 units being lost, that's going to be
many men, women,
and children, especially out on the street. It's not just the young man.
No, it's mostly families, actually, in the Section 8 housing.
What we've seen is families and elderly.
Yeah.
It's kind of the most
common. I don't know of any single person that's being in that kind of thing.
So a lot of the federal programs, Section 8 being one of them for low-income housing, have been cut way back, and that's had that kind of impact. And then you have the impact of urban renewal and gentrification and highway demolition, interestingly enough. It often goes through the low-income parts of the city to build new expressways and bridge underpasses and all this kind of thing. In our city, there used to be a section right near the main bridge that went from Philadelphia over to New Jersey, and it was called the Tenderloin. I guess that was the term for a lot of cities. And a lot of very, very poor people and hobos and so on lived in there. And you could get a room for 50 cents to a dollar a night. But now there's been a whole lot of urban renewal and highway construction in that area, and that whole area has just been totally demolished and kind of urban renewed. In New York City, they say that 87% of that type of housing has now been destroyed through urban renewal or highway construction or gentrification. Nationwide, the figure is 1,116,000 of these cheap hotel, single room occupancy places have been destroyed by these programs, with very little to replace them. So it means in Philadelphia, for example, and I think in most places around the country, people who would have lived, you know, poorly and in a cruddy little room and stuff, but at least have a roof over their head, now are out on the street because that whole area of housing has been destroyed. And the final thing, and this is not to say this is not the whole treatise on housing. I mean, lots of other things have been happening. But the other thing is just that there's been a tremendous inflation in the housing market, and the cost of housing has gone up a lot faster than the cost of living, and rising much faster than people's incomes. So a lot of people who were kind of lower middle class or just kind of hanging on, working class people, as these costs escalated and the salary didn't escalate, they have fallen into homelessness also. The other thing I wanted to refer to before we kind of go back to some discussion and some another little exercise is this mental illness question. And I'm quoting here from a book that I just would recommend to you extremely strongly. It's called Nowhere to Go, The Tragic Odyssey of the Homeless Mentally Ill. Nowhere to Go, The Tragic Odyssey of the Homeless Mentally Ill. It's written by a psychiatrist. His name is E. Fuller Torrey, T-O-R-R-E-Y. And it's one of those kind of once in a lifetime books, in the sense that it's written with tremendous scholarship, you know, lots of footnotes, and I mean it's obviously that he's read everything on the subject and really done his homework, but also with real passion. You know, he's a person who's outraged at what has happened with the homeless mentally ill, And he's a real reformer, but a very well-informed reformer. And I knew that there had been such a thing as deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill in this country. And I knew that probably not enough preparation had been done to take care of people who were put out of mental hospitals, who were released from mental hospitals. But beyond that, I didn't really know very much. And what he did was to just fill this in very beautifully. And I thought you might be interested, again, how a broad social force as a result of a public policy has caused homelessness out on the streets. In the late 1940s and early 50s, there were a number of exposés of the kind of the horrors of big mental hospitals, state mental hospitals. Remember in Life magazine, there was a big photo essay of people, you know, naked in the halls and urinating on the floors, and there's no care, and they became known as snake pits. You know, yeah, that was the word that was used. And what happened was that people were horrified by this, and at the same time, the psychiatric community was discovering that there were certain drugs that could be used which could maintain people, and like if they were hallucinating, could help to control the hallucinations, or if they were paranoid, could control the paranoia, so that a person actually could function, as long as they were taking this medicine, they could function out in the community in a pretty normal fashion. So they were saying, well, maybe a real reform would be to not think of putting people in these big institutions, these snake pits, but to establish little community mental health centers all over the country, and then we would release people from the hospitals. They would be picked up by these community health centers, which would give them the medication that they need. They would be given some training and some support for living normally in the community, and they would be integrated back into the community, and that would be wonderful. You know, we would get rid of the snake pits. So it was not a bad idea as an idea. So there were a series of laws passed in the 1950s and 60s to start this going. And from 1955 to 1984, which was the latest statistics he had, 433,707 patients had been released from public mental hospitals and out into the street. So about under the street, the idea was to put them into, you know, nice places. So about 500,000 people by this time have been released from public mental hospitals and into the community. The results were, instead of the kind of beautiful dream of the reformers, were that tens of thousands of these patients have become homeless. And I run into them, you know, every day in my work, seriously mentally ill people who, instead of coming into community health centers, are coming into shelters for help. Many, many of them, and increasing numbers of them, are now in jail. The estimates, when he was writing this, which was 2 years ago, were that there were 67,500 mentally ill people who had been released from mental hospitals and now were in prison. That was how they were being housed, you know, from the snake pit to the prison. And what he called this, I thought it was a very moving term, he called it the criminalization of psychosis. The criminalization of psychosis. And what obviously had happened was that these people had been released, they hadn't been picked up by the mental health system, and they had done something, you know, they had broken a window or done something or attacked somebody, and bang, into prison they went. The seriously mentally ill people were released without very much provision for their aftercare or their follow-up after coming out of these hospitals. And this all happened at the time when there was a decrease in the amount of low-income housing that we've talked about before. What went wrong? Well, the lack of low-income housing. But the thing which I had not realized was that they had made very careful estimates about, well, if we have 500,000 people in mental hospitals, how many community health centers will we need, you know, scattered throughout the country to pick them up as they are released from the mental hospitals so that they can get their medication, can get some ongoing training, can get into sheltered workshops, you know, that type of thing. Well, they estimated that that we would need about 2,000 such community health centers all over the country. But when it came to funding them, they only funded 789 such centers. So really less than half of what was needed. And that, of course, created tremendous problems that they just were not able to reach the people who were released. But then another problem was that the community mental health centers themselves, in many cases, didn't see their function particularly as relating to the seriously mentally ill that were coming out of the mental hospitals, but more working with kind of the worried well, what they call people who have, you know, mental problems or neuroses or whatever. And they tended to become the clientele more of the community health centers than of the seriously mentally ill coming out of the hospitals. Another problem that was recognized back in the 40s and 50s was that we didn't have enough psychiatrists, enough psychiatric social workers, and so on. And so an enormous amount of money was spent to help train mental health specialists, professionals. $2 billion was spent between 1948 and 1984 for, you know, to subsidize education, provide scholarships, and all this kind of thing. And the results, I didn't realize this until I read the book, was that there was a tenfold increase in the number of psychiatrists and psychologists in the United States, a 27-fold increase in the number of psychiatric social workers, and other health professionals, mental health professionals also were increased dramatically. But the problem was that there was no requirement made that if you got this funding, you had to work, or at least spend some of your time working with the seriously mentally ill. So a lot of people just went and put up their shingle in, you know, the community where they could get the best, the $50 an hour or whatever that the psychiatrist or whatever can earn. Now, that's not to say all did that, because there are many dedicated people that we know who do serve the low-income people, but there was no requirement that they do that, and so the economic incentive was to go where the money was rather than where the seriously mentally ill were. So that was just, that helped me to understand why I see so many mentally ill people in my work, and also helped me to kind of focus on that broad question of how a policy change. Talk about homelessness, but often we don't define, you know, what is homelessness? What does homelessness really mean? Is a person living in a shelter homeless? I mean, they have a roof over their heads. Okay, here's the first definition. Now, you don't have to write these down unless you just want to put maybe a 1, 2, 3 up there. Number one, homelessness is a condition of being without a place to live caused by individuals who squander their resources and dissipate their lives through laziness, drug and alcohol use, or refusal to accept treatment for mental illness. That would be number one. Number two, homelessness is a condition forced upon people who, for whatever reason, are so poor that they cannot afford even the cheapest available housing, and so must live on the streets or in shelters. Okay. And number three, homelessness is a condition in which Jesus Christ, in the distressing disguise of the poor, finds himself having to live on the street or in a shelter because of society's lack of compassion for the poorest, the most distressed, and the most vulnerable. Yeah. Do you want me to read them all again, or just like that? Okay. Homelessness is a condition in which Jesus Christ, in the distressing disguise of the poor, finds himself having to live on the street or in a shelter because of society's lack of compassion for the poorest, the most distressed, and the most vulnerable. Good, you have a good model. He's a good scribe. So let's just get us a show of hands here. I know these are kind of deep things to think about on a Thursday afternoon, but just, you know, without getting graded on this or anything, how many people would be for number one?
You have to only choose one.
Excuse me?
You have to only choose one out of this room.
Yeah, we'll try to choose one. This was the laziness, drug abuse, refusal to accept treatment. Okay, not so many folks for that. How about number two?
Number two.
Okay. Homelessness is a condition forced upon people who, for whatever reason, are so poor that they cannot afford even the cheapest available housing, and so must live on the street or in shelters. How many? One, two, three, four, five. Nine. And then the one about Jesus living on the street. How many people say that? Okay.
Are you ignoring all the people who are Buddhist, Mohammedan, Jewish, and so on? You see, that was, I think that it's the wording of it is. Maybe that's what you wanted us to take, but I mean, I
no, 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 no.
Oh,
no,
because yeah. I'm thinking, okay, all of these, for there are poor there, and they have someone else. But they think that's right away.
I wasn't trying to set it up or anything like that.
I wonder if it was.
Well, maybe you'll find out I was trying to set it up. I don't know. I think these three definitions, at least as we worked with them in our little seminar back in Philadelphia, that they imply different concepts of what the cause are, and therefore also imply different ways to work for a solution. If you believe the problem is mostly just laziness and drug and alcohol abuse and so on, then your approach would be a little bit on the punitive side, perhaps, but if you're a compassionate person still, you'd provide a shelter for them,
And the ones that didn't seem lazy, huh?
Yeah, and your shelter might have quite a few rules in it too, which some shelters do, you have to accept treatment to be in the shelter and so on and so forth. But your focus would really be on them. I mean, they're the ones that are at fault because of their, what they've done to themselves, and so you'd be focusing on them, and maybe you'd, like some places you have to listen to a sermon before you can get fed, and they're the old style ones, but we have them in Philadelphia too. This one would be more focused around, it's more outer focused, it's more aimed at the need for public policy changes. That there is not enough housing available, there are not enough programs of various kinds available, and therefore our effort should be to go out, in a lobbying kind of way or a pressure kind of way, or encouraging our senators and members of the House to really get with it with decent programs to make up for the lacks.
Seems like there you move from blaming the individual in number one to ignoring the individual in number two.
Yeah, that might be a
ignoring,
a fault.
Empowering an individual who's in a situation. I don't know.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah.
And as important as policy is.
Well, I want to come to that. I mean, hold that a second. Let me go through the three, because it might be that some combination of the three would be, the one that this is, and I put it up there because one member of our group kind of kept coming back to that. He said, "Yeah, it's true that the housing has really, the amount of low-income housing has really gone downhill over the last years and all this, but why have we elected people who put those kind of policies in place? I mean, we can't just blame them. We, at least the majority of us did elect that, and we seem pretty happy with it, basically. I mean, George Bush's popularity rating is very, very high and everything. Maybe there's something even deeper going on than bad policies, or maybe it's more rooted in the fundamental values of our society. And it's not just that we need sort of liberal, more liberal programs, great society, war and poverty kind of thing. But maybe we need to kind of do almost like a cultural evangelism, and remembering how in Matthew 25, Jesus said, "Inasmuch as you do it to the least of these, my brethren, you do it to me," to see these people who are homeless as the people that Christ was talking about, the guy on the piece of cardboard on the steam vent, that's Jesus Christ, you know, sitting there with the steam coming up around him. And if that's your view, then you have kind of another approach. You're trying to come at it kind of, and I'm not trying to argue at this point for either of the three, but just as a background for talking about solutions. Now, what do we think about solutions? How would you go at the solutions of homelessness?
Oh, I thought you were going to say, what do you think about this? I want to say, I like number three until you got to that it's because of society's lack of compassion, because I do believe that the message of the New Testament is that we are to see Jesus in all the unfortunate, in everybody, fortunate or unfortunate, actually. But I don't think that the overwhelming reason for homelessness in society is lack of compassion. I think there are a lot of really complicated factors in it. And one of the things that's frustrating to me is what I keep hearing is the insistence on that it's a federal government problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not comfortable with that. I think the further we push it away, the less we've dealt with it. The more we've just said, I wash my hands of it, you take care of it, George Bush. And I just don't think it's George Bush's problem.
Do you have another way that you would go about it?
I sure don't have the answers. No, but I think it's a lot more complicated than I think we deny the complications of the issue when we push it further away. And we make it, I mean, it's real complicated to take care of it locally because, for instance, we come from Southern California. And because of the climate, we could end up with all the homeless in Southern California. You know, so then you start feeling like, well, the other states ought to be helping take care of these folks too. You know, it shouldn't be just up to Santa Monica. But on the other hand, I think the further we remove it, the more it takes away from us as people. And I count myself among the lesser of the people that have dealt with that because I haven't had a lot of hands-on experience with it, and I've already, in the course of this hour, have determined I'm going to do more. But
that's nice.
Yep. Well, we come from a very small community of 30,000, 40,000.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several things. We have what we call Welcome In, United Fund. Backing it, as well as all of our church groups.
What was it called? Welcome In?
Welcome In. And it's a church that has been taken over. But I mean, you know, anyone in the community, we're small enough when you're that size that they can get to that place, and that's a place to stay. And then, of course, Salvation Army has the soup kitchen, the meals 5 days a week. On Saturday, churches of the community, many of the youth groups have been taking turns for years, and about a year ago, two of our churches, the one we have to belong to, and one other church said, we will do it every Sunday. And there's one church, rather than moving it around to different churches, we keep it at one church for the weekend. And so when we have worked several times on Sunday or more than that, I guess, and about three, four families, and usually we prepare the food and donate it, and we serve up to 55 people. Now, this is a small community, of course, and we recognize when we did it last November, December, and we did it now in June, I mean, we're getting many of the same people. The end of the month, you get families coming in. The first Sunday of the month, then you don't get as many, they've just gotten their food stamps. But someone said, well, how do you check whether they really deserve it? We said, we don't. And I mean, this is the philosophy. They sign their name when they come in. And I know the minister of the particular church where we have this said, they own several properties in town, but they like, or that fellow does, but he likes the social bit of it. So he left a check here last Sunday for it. But I mean, this is a way where the churches, as well as the community, in a small community, now you see, we're not talking about New York City and Philadelphia and so on, except that you have neighborhoods. Well, I suppose the trouble is you get your, see, that's an alien world to us. We don't know. But I mean, it's still alien how you work that because you'd have to have your suburban groups, I suppose, take over certain places. But
But I feel that that's, you know, society's compassion and a more personal touch.
Mm-hmm.
And those who still have their teenage children at home will bring them down to help on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really, the teenagers, they say this is good training for them, mm-hmm. to learn that we help some that are less fortunate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't you think in espousing federally supported things, or pushing that harder, the government support, it's that old idea of if I can pay for it, it allows me as a person to say, well, that's the way I'm doing it, and not to become personally involved.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of gets you off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
I've let the government take over so many mm-hmm. programs. Mm-hmm. I can remember.
And I'll give my money, but I don't want to get personally involved.
Mm-hmm.
As
well.
Nobody wants their taxes raised, though.
No.
But a friend of mine who had lived in Mankato for many years said, the families that had been there before, they sort of had a family. That they always made sure there were plenty of little handyman jobs around the place. She was talking about the family. Yeah, see, that personal touch that you're talking about can be
important. Okay, we're coming up real quick to the end, so I just want to make sure people have their hand up.
Okay, I'm just going to be a devil's advocate because mm-hmm. I worked at a shelter for a little while, and some of the attitude of some of the people that were there was that us Christians were coming down and we were fixing the meals and we're kind of getting our Christ thing, but we're not empowering these people. We don't really respect them. We really, you know, these people need to be empowered somehow or other. They need to have self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is we're getting our goody-two-shoes feeling, mm-hmm. and we're coming down and we're showing them and we're doing these things for them. But we're not really empowering them. We're not really taking them. We're not really accepting them. And so it was kind of like, well, here comes the Christians marching through, and we'll be the good little puppets and
say. Well, then, are you saying don't feed the monster?
No, I don't know what the answer is. I'm just saying that this is it's a real interesting thing. How can we do it with an attitude that empowers the people that we're doing it for?
We're gonna do Megan and then Heather. Sorry, how did I get Megan? And then we're going to call it officially to a close, but if people want to stay around unofficially afterwards, but we're supposed to only go for an hour, so...